Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, are you ready? Are you ready?
Get ready, dog. Get ready.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Rocket Networker. I always like to begin with a silly networking story. Today's story is about staying in touch with people in your personal network. About 15 years ago, I walked into a friend's office and he said, "Do you remember Bob Mitchell?" And I replied, "The one that played football for the Rockets?" He said, "Yes, he just got back from another tour leading medevac flight operations in the Middle East." So I reached out to Bob to reconnect. As we talked, I mentioned that a friend at West Point, now retired General Bernie Banks, was an Apache battalion commander. Bob replied, "Bernie was my roommate at Fort Rucker before I deployed to the Middle East." Over the past 30 years, I've had the privilege of interacting with University of Toledo alums and military leaders from across the United States and around the world. Their stories and success always amaze me. And that's where today's Rocket Networker guest comes in, Bob Mitchell. While we attended college at different times, we share a common bond through our love of Rocket football, the Rocket Nation, and the U.S. Army. Bob, thank you for your service to our country, brother, and for making time in your busy schedule to join us here on the Rocket Networker podcast. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
So we're going to get into the concept here in the Rocket Networker podcast that we call the threads of connectivity. In simple terms, Bob, I think of the threads are just the little things in life that connect us, right? In the business world, everybody wants to give you their sales pitch about their business. But you and I both know that where business comes from is relationships. And where relationships come from are those threads, the little teeny things that tie us together, our hometown, our family, our military service, community volunteerism, our children. Those are the things that I think most of us want to talk about more so than work. Is that fair, Bob?
Yeah, it sounds excellent.
So let's do this. Let's go back in time. So let's talk about your hometown, man. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
Oh, Rick, first, thanks for having me on here. Just being, you know, you picking me to come on, that's a Heisman Trophy for me, all right? So that's good.
Thank you.
Grew up in, I was born in Marion, Ohio. My parents moved to Northwest Ohio in Swanton when I was young. That's where I went to grade school. And I went to Swanton High School, and that's where I found a passion for sports. I wish I was just a little bit better on the academic side, but I had there wasn't much to do. People weren't walking around with cell phones in their hand, and they weren't on the computer. They were outside. They were playing, and they were doing the things they needed to do. So in Swanton, I was fortunate enough to have a coach. I came from divorced parents. I had a high school football coach, Dave Hansbarger, Hall of Fame there in Ohio as well. And the stadium there at Swanton is named after him. Oh. He kind of took me under his wing. And what he did was he told me in so many terms, you need to have goals. What is it you want to do? And I said, well, I want to be quarterback of the high school football team. I was in junior high school. And he goes, okay. What do you got to do to get to that point? I had no idea.
Right.
So what he did was he kind of pointed me in the right directions and what I needed to do. It was the first time I got a taste of leadership from somebody else, mentoring, coaching me. And I just gravitated to it. And I was fortunate enough. I took his advice. And what happened was I ended up starting for the team. We were very successful. We had an undefeated high school football team. We missed the playoffs by this much. We had, I went to the University of Toledo. We had another person that went to Ohio University. Our arch rival team in Northwest Ohio, Delta High School, also went undefeated. Their whole backfield went to Clemson University on a full ride scholarship. We had talent within the league that I was playing in, but Coach Hansbarger was, he was the genesis of what I have been able to accomplish today. So that's right, where it all comes.
So take me back a little further in there. Did you have siblings or anything? You have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I had one sister and I had two brothers that I know about. They weren't involved in sports as much as I was. Yeah, we grew up small family. We ended up being a blended family. It was kind of like the Brady.
Talk a little bit about high school for you beyond sports. What was it like? Or was it like literally like all sports all the time? What was it like?
Well, yeah, I would say that's a yes and no kind of answer there, Rick. My coach was always trying to make sure that, hey, there's two sides of the story here. You're a scholar athlete, so you need to study. And he had to kind of force me. But you had to kind of balance those two out together. The teachers were great. They also let us know. They kind of kept us in check. You know, if you start getting write-ups in the newspaper, there's no such thing as people coming down with cameras or, you know, podcasts or anything like that that were going out that time frame. So everything was pretty much print media.
Right.
But you start seeing your name in the paper of, hey, you did this during this week and you did that. And hey, everybody's like loving you and the team is doing good.
Right.
The teachers are going to bring you back down to earth. You come in with a faulty assignment or you didn't meet the requirements, they're going to let you know. So they kind of kept us well grounded. The athletes that I would say had a reputation out there to bring distinction with the school, but they had to keep us well grounded. Hey, your ego getting a little out of check here. We're going to bring you back down to earth. Right. So let's get back and let's rewrite that paper.
You played football for the Rockets. What was that like? Take us like freshman year, sophomore year. What was that like when you first got into college playing football?
Well, when I go back to when I was being recruited, I actually thought I was going to go to the University of Michigan. I was heavily recruited. They wanted me to go into the running back versus a quarterback. Now, they brought in a new guy. He was there a freshman a year earlier. His name was Rick Leach.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rick did a great job up there at Michigan for 4 years. Quarterbacking in Michigan wasn't going to happen. I know that when Bo Schembechler came down, he was in my area for signing day. He was at the other arch rival high school at Delta trying to recruit those guys. And the coach who was recruiting me out of Michigan said, hey, we don't know if Bo, it was kind of like a coin flip. Was Bo going to come down there to the high school? Well, we were waiting. And I'm like, okay. Well, at the same time, I've got Don Nayland that's at Bowling Green. He's waiting for my decision. And Jack Murphy's waiting for my decision at the University of Toledo. I'm waiting for Bo Schembechler.
Right.
It didn't happen. Again, another nice reality that you may not be as good as you actually think you are. So keep everything in check. Right. So it was a toss up between Bowling Green and Toledo. My parents wanted me to go to Toledo. It was obviously a little bit closer. So I chose the University of Toledo. Going from high school as a high school star to seniors that are huge, that you're like, there's no way anybody could be this big and this fast. You're just a small number. You're starting out again.
Right.
That was a huge awakening at that point. It was an eye opener. We were not that successful my freshman year at the University of Toledo in 1976. But what it did was the my freshman class that came in, it actually gave us an opportunity. Since we weren't doing too well, we actually had an opportunity to play a little bit. I actually got into some games as a quarterback as a freshman. Jeff Heppenstall was the quarterback at that time. I was his backup, and he got hurt a few times, so I would go in, and that was a big difference. And it was a learning process. So the first year at UT completely had really no idea what was going on, but it's a full time job. You've got to balance the academics in any kind of social life. You're gonna have a social life in college. It's a juggling act. It really is. But then my sophomore year, Jack Murphy was let go. The staff was let go. And we got this guy named Chuck Stobart. Oh, by the way, was Bo Schembechler's offensive coordinator. He comes down to the University of Toledo. And oh, my goodness, boy, did the stuff hit the fan. He was running a military operation. Again, another reason why I joined the military, because it seemed like it was so close. I was ready.
You're ready to go.
So Chuck Stobart comes in and he brings his staff down and, you know, they're trying to make an impression. This is their program. It's not. And again, as Jack Murphy was winding down, he was part of the glory days. He had the last year of the 35-0. So there was a lot of history there. There was a, you know, and again, great coach, well-respected. But anytime you're a player, you're a coach, and you're living through that transition when you do coaching changes, it's pretty tough.
It is.
So you owe your allegiance to the new group that's coming in. And it was tough. He got rid of a lot of players. He used the model that Bo Schembechler used, and that is play like a champion. All right?
Right.
So to those who stay will be champions was another one that he used. We had a lot of players that just said, nope, this isn't for me. And again, it's another test of leadership. Do you have the grit? Do you have the dedication? Do you have the perseverance to hang here? And if you do, you're going to become winners. And what we saw was over the next 3 years, we ended up, we didn't take the MAC championship, but we took second place. We were tied right. going into the last game. We lost the last game to Northern Illinois, and Central Michigan took the championship. We were tied for them with them. That was my only regret, that we didn't get an outright MAC championship. But again, from high school to college within the University of Toledo, fundamental leadership building block techniques that
right.
still stay to me today.
Right.
It's amazing. It's amazing what the University of Toledo, that is not getting any credit for this right now, but you know, I'm 66. I'm still doing things that I feel are giving back to the community or providing leadership. And I got that at the University of Toledo and
right.
Swanton High School with my high school football coach. So
right.
hats off to them.
Yeah, can't say I'm enough. With you. Those coaches are special, especially the high school and grade school ones that aren't getting a lot of fame and glory out of it. They're just there because they want to build good leaders for the future, right? So, sorry. So you're at UT, the football thing's here, you got academics going on, you know, you're living college life and you're having fun. What's not to be fun about being a college athlete and going to school? That's cool. So now talk a little bit about senior year. You start thinking about life now after college. Like, oh my God, it's like, we're going to graduate now. Now what in the world am I going to do now? So where did your mind, let us into Bobby Mitchell's mind.
Well, my mind rolled into your brother, Dr. Clint. Now, Dr. Clint had a plan.
Yeah.
And he would always tell me, hey, Bobby, hey, I know you're having fun at parties. We're doing great on the football field. The team is winning. We're doing great, but you got to have a plan. Here's Clint already giving me leadership guidance.
Right.
I appreciated that. He obviously knew what he wanted to do right at. I think he went and did his PhD right after that, I believe.
He did,
or his master's and his PhD.
Yeah.
I really didn't know. And my degree was in communications, so it wasn't something that was – and the economy was doing real bad in the early 80s. I mean, it was down. It was depressed.
It was down. Yeah.
When I graduated, I had three job offers. Graduated from UT, but I had three job offers. One was with the Ohio State Highway Patrol. I thought they had the baddest looking uniforms.
They do.
And I had enough tickets from them. I had a lot of respect for them, okay? And I thought I might want to be a state trooper. In fact, we had a previous football player. I think his name was either Al Harris. I forget what his name was, but he went to the Ohio State Highway Patrol and he ended up making lieutenant or something. But he kind of got me down that road. Hey, you might want to look at this thing. And then I had a job offer from Prudential Life Insurance Company, which I'm like, okay. And then there was this, then I got into the recruiting for the Army about flying helicopters that you had previously talked about. Okay.
We share that in common, a dream.
Yes. Ronald Reagan is in office, you know, and he's pumping up the military and he's making you feeling good about serving. And I'm like, you know, that might not be such a bad call. Then I went out and I got my private pilot's license for airplanes. Okay. So I did that on my own.
Okay.
It was awfully expensive. So I'm like, hey, you know, this military thing is looking more and more like it's the road to kind of go because they can pay for my flight training. The only bad thing was I got to give them 10 years of my life.
Right.
And it was the Cold War then. So we had minor little operations, nothing major going on. So it looked like a good bet. But, you know, I went in there to the military shortly after I graduated with the idea of getting flight training and then maybe going on to the airlines or doing something professionally flying. And then again, what I found out was it was like football. It was like UT. It was like all that organization that you have, the teams and the camaraderie and what you're doing. It just became fun. don't know too many people that say the Army is fun, but we had great leadership. We had great leadership, and what I was doing, they were actually paying me to fly helicopters. I'm like, well, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
And then it kept going. It kept going. And every time I was even thinking about leaving the military, it always happens. You either get promoted or you get selected for command. You're like, oh, I can't leave now.
So did you go into the Army then, like right after graduation, or was there a gap of a year or two?
No, there was a little bit of a gap. There was about a year and a half gap. Like I said, I went out and got my private pilot's license. That took about 8 months to do that.
Right.
And I got the first taste and inkling of what aviation was about. And I found that that was my passion. I found a niche that I was trying to find.
Right.
That I didn't necessarily find in the undergraduate program at UT. I mean, you know, most people when they graduate don't actually do what they actually went to school for.
Right.
It just shows that, okay, you have the propensity to complete something. So I know this doesn't have anything to do with your degree, but go do this and do great things. So I still had some decisions to kind of make. I wasn't ready to commit to something, but I always thought I was going to end up in the military. So if I was going to do that, that was a pretty big commitment. You don't just go, hey, I think I want to do this on a whim and serve 10 years.
Right.
That could be a bad mistake if you're not a good fit for what you're doing. So there was about a year and a half that I took off to kind of make this decision.
Right. What was the process that you went through, you know, from, let's just pick it up even at boot camp. How did you get from boot camp to flying helicopters? Like, what was that transition like?
Well, since I didn't do reserve officer training, we had, and the reason why I didn't do that, I didn't do ROTC when I was at UT. We had this All-American linebacker named Aaron Bivens that was there at the same time. He came back from Ranger School, and he was emaciated. I mean, the Ranger School is a leadership school, and you are really not eating, sleeping, doing anything for about 90 days in various environments. It's teaching you leadership principles to be miserable but still accomplish the mission. When he came back, when he left, he was 235 pounds. He came back, he was like 190 pounds. Wow. And I'm going, whoa, I don't want to have anything to do with ROTC. That doesn't look like fun.
I just want to fly helicopters, dude. I don't want to.
I'm not looking to, you know, be miserable. But when he came back, that was my driving factor at that point, not to go into ROTC.
Right.
I had to go to basic camp because I did not do anything with ROTC, and it was a rude awakening. The challenge was you're going to be miserable. You're going to be doing a lot of things you really don't want to do.
Right.
You're going to be hungry. You're going to be tired. You're going to be it just fundamental leadership. Can you do things when you don't want to do them?
Right.
So it was a great teaching point. I ended up being the what they call the trainee of the cycle. I had the highest physical training scores, and obviously, you know, playing football at UT, that was pretty easy. But, again, when I did that, natural leadership started to come out, and I said, you know, I think I'm where I'm supposed to be.
Okay.
Then from there, I went right directly to flight school down in Alabama. It was Fort Rucker. We call it Fort Novacell now, but that's the home of Army Aviation.
That's cool. That's very cool.
So the flight school was approximately a year long. So you're immersed in as a flight student. And again, just learning how to fly the aircraft, learning how to fly in instrument conditions, and then learning how to tactically employ your aircraft in a combat environment. Because number one is that we support the ground forces.
Right.
Nobody supports aviation. We support the ground forces.
Right.
The Navy supports the ground forces. The Air Force supports the ground forces. So it's that infantryman on the ground who is the number one priority for all the military services.
Right.
So we got a chance to learn that, and that was a pretty good teaching point there.
That's kind of cool. So, all right. So now when you came out of that, I've heard the term over the years, chief warrant officer. Is that when you came out of flight school? Is that what you were then? Or
The reason why I didn't go in as a commissioned officer at first, I went in as a warrant officer, is because that was the only opportunity to get to flight school.
Right.
I was told by the recruiting manager that I needed to go to Fort Benning and go through infantry officer basic, become a lieutenant, and then apply for flight school because there was no aviation branch within the Army. It was sort of like an additional duty. You're an infantryman first. It's kind of like the Marines.
Yeah.
But it was a risk that I didn't want to take. So they said, well, if you go down the warrant officer route, then you can go right into flight school. And that's what I did.
Right. Smart. Smart move.
But then when I graduated, I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division, the 82nd Combat Aviation Battalion. And the leadership found out real quick. They said, hey, you need to go to OCS and become a commissioned officer. Well, I didn't need to do that. I just applied paperwork, and they gave me a second lieutenant promotion, kind of like through the mail. I mean, I was already qualified.
So it was a smart move.
Yeah.
It was a smart move.
And then 31 years later.
Yeah. Talk about the work from there. Where did it go?
So one of the seminal assignments that I had was the 82nd Airborne Division. Outstanding officers, outstanding non-commissioned officers. The warrant officers were the pilots who flew the helicopters.
Right.
The commissioned officers are the ones that organized, planned, and executed the mission from command and control standpoint.
Right.
So I start to learn all this. And plus, we're in the 82nd Airborne Division. Everybody jumps out of an airplane in the 82nd Airborne Division. Okay. Okay. Not to mention, it was extra pay to jump out of the airplane. So that was an added incentive.
Right.
I found that when I started doing jump operations and I'm doing the flight operations, I mean, I was in heaven. I'm like,
having a blast.
This is great stuff. And from the time that I left the University of Toledo and then got to the U.S. Army and then Fort Bragg, North Carolina with the 82nd Airborne Division, that was 1983. And they were now coming back from Grenada, the first operation that the U.S. military had since Vietnam.
Right.
There, we had some outstanding officers that I still stay in touch with today that coached me, mentored me, allowed me to make honest mistakes, and then put you down the right path, provide opportunity for you to go out there. And if you're an officer in the United States Army, the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Air Force, you're looking at the next generation that's coming up. You shouldn't really be focused on your career and what's happening. It is you are training, leading, mentoring the next generation. So I see that now with my son, who is a major in the United States Army at the Pentagon. I know him as a child, and now he is leading officers, NCOs. He's been deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq multiple times. You want to make sure that the next generation is doing the right thing. So it's almost like when you're in the military, you have children. Those people that are going to be coming are your children. You treat them just like your children. And it's an important responsibility, and that's what I got out of the military the whole time. I mean, that was that was clearly the driving factor why I stayed 30 years.
So you're through Bragg, we're through Grenada. How do we get from Bragg to Iraq and Afghanistan?
So a typical commissioned officer's, you know, career path is going to be developmental jobs at the lieutenant captain level to prepare them for company command.
Right.
Platoon command, company command is the lowest level, and you start to you're responsible for that organization. You're responsible for everything the unit does and does not do. That's the big distinction.
Yeah.
But if your unit does not do good in combat or operations, and they're not meeting muster to the things they need to do, then the commander is going to be relieved, and your career is essentially over. So the buck stops at the commander. So those formative years between, we're talking about Fort Bragg as a lieutenant, by the time I was a lieutenant colonel at Fort Hood getting ready to deploy to Iraq, those were all developmental assignments from captain, major, and lieutenant colonel. You go to various schools. The good thing about the military, you're going to be going to school about once every 2 or 3 years for a year. So you're back in the classroom.
Right.
That's one of those great things that a lot of people don't realize, but you're educated and you are required to stay up to speed. Your continuing education on tactics, techniques, procedures, national security policy, national military strategy, et cetera, et cetera. So various assignments. I was in Korea. I was in Fort Hood, Texas, Fort Bragg. I had an assignment up in the Department of the Army up in Washington, D.C. I was an assignment officer. And then I went to Command General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas for a year. And then was a medevac company commander at Fort Hood, Texas. When 911 kicked off, I'm going into work that early Monday morning and the Twin Towers were hit. Everything stopped. We knew things had changed like that overnight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Spring this thing forward to at the same installation, Fort Hood. I command a medevac company. I'm a medical brigade XO after that. And then I get selected for battalion commands. We knew that we were going to be going back into Iraq.
Right.
So fast forward that to 2013, I'm in command of a medevac battalion, multi-compo, which means I've got National Guard, Reserve, active duty from all over the United States. We train with, and then we show up in the box in Iraq to do the fight. So in 2003, President Bush made the decision we were going to go down and topple the regime. We go in, and it was not the first tour, but the second tour. I'm in command of 1,000 soldiers, 75 medevac Black Hawk helicopter. It was a dream come true. You know, as I look back on all that, I didn't even realize the burdensome of command. It's a lonely position.
It is.
It's a very lonely position. Mm-hmm. But doggone, you know, command in America's finest. And my organization, we had some great leaders. We had some great soldiers. They did some great things. And our unit did some great things. It was right. The highlight of my career. And I would do it all over again. Wouldn't even bat an eye to do it again.
Right. Well, thank you for the service, especially in combat. Did you do one tour with them as a battalion commander, or had you gone over a couple times?
2003, I was a brigade XO, so we had multiple battalions underneath there. So I was the number two in charge as the executive officer. And then I took command when we came back to out of Iraq the first time in 2003. We got back in 2004. I took command in 2004.
Got it.
And then in late 2004 and in 2005, I was in Iraq with the battalion.
Let's pause for a moment. How confident are you that your team knows what to talk about when meeting new people and engaging with people already in their personal network? Are there conversations expediting trust and relationships that lead to results? Or is it time to enhance their skill set and their approach to these conversations? Let's schedule a time to talk about adding the threads of connectivity to their networking, referral, and relationship development approach. Which works best for you and your team? A speech at your next annual meeting, a training workshop, or coaching sessions for individuals and small groups? Visit rocketnetworker.com to schedule a conversation today. Let's launch connections to ignite their success. Are you ready? Now, let's return to the Rocket Networker guest.
Hi, Rick. But, you know, the one thing that you kind of that struck a chord here that you said is that, you know, anybody that was downrange in combat at that time, I can guarantee you they're lying if they're telling you otherwise. They don't want to be there. I mean, you do it because it's your duty.
It's your job.
You know, if somebody would say off the street, hey, you want to go downrange and get, you know, I mean, there's some bad stuff going on, but no. The person who has a sane mind and is somewhat educated is going to say, no, that's high risk and we don't want to do that. So right. I would tell you from personal experience being there, you don't really want to be there, but commanding the forces, commanding the troops makes it so much easier. It's easy to be the leader. It's much harder to be the follower when you're in those kinds of formations.
Right.
So I feel like I had an easy job, but we all did not want to be there. We would rather be home with the family, but
right.
You know, that's what it called for. And where did that come from? That came from the training on the football field there in the Glass Bowl.
Right. So you come off of your battalion command tour in combat. Where does the journey go? How do we get from there to today?
So right after battalion command, if you're successful, usually this is what happens. You get selected for the Army War College. And that's what happened to me. So I'm at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania for a year. We get to kind of, you know, immerse ourselves in things like global leadership. And how the National Command Authority works and the national security strategy, national military strategy. And again, it's a higher level thinking, but it's very relaxed. It's open. It's adult learning. There's no pressure on you. You have to take a test you got to score a certain. I mean, this was really great for the senior officers that were there for the course. It was a think tank. And of course, we all got our opinions. And in the mornings when we would discuss these things, discussion items, it always killed me every time when we get done with it. We only had like 30 to 40 minutes to discuss it. We want hours to discuss this stuff,
right.
But you can't do that because you're in an academic environment.
Right.
So lieutenant colonels are there. A few of these people are going to make general officer. So again, you got to have the right assignments. You got to have the right luck. And then, you know, there are going to be people that are going to be selected. So this course is grooming them for the next level of senior leadership.
Right.
Within the Department of Defense, because we had Naval, Marine, Coast Guard, and then Army at the Army War College, but we also had interagency. We had people from the FBI, the CIA. So we get to hear all these perspectives that we're not used to hearing. You know, we're not working with the State Department.
Right, right.
So
right.
When they come in and they're part of this group, they're students as well. What a great dialogue that we get.
Cool.
Invaluable education.
Mm-hmm.
So I leave there and I come back to Mother Rucker, back here to Fort Rucker, now Fort Novosel. And I am in charge of the medevac proponency, which means basically I'm kind of overseeing the whole program, the acquisition of the aircraft. I'm not doing the acquisition. I just kind of oversee it and give it some strategic, you know, this is where the Army Medical Department wants to go with their medevac aircraft in the future. We get involved in training, doctrine, leadership training, and et cetera. So it's kind of like a one-stop shop for medevac operations to include the flight training of the flight paramedics that are back in the aircraft. I'm selected for brigade command. I went through a divorce too. It was a bad time. So I had to decline command. And that kind of took me off the career track, the fast track on the Army side by doing that. No regrets. It was just, when you go to war for a long time, there are going to be things that are going to eventually catch up to you and there's a bill to pay. So I know a lot of my senior brothers and sisters, they kind of went through the same things. It's just the nature of the beast. But I was not willing to continue my career at the sacrifice of some of the things I needed to do for family time at that time frame. So I declined brigade command and stayed there at Fort Rucker. And then they pulled me out of there and sent me to Joint Base San Antonio to the requirements and determination proponency there. So I led a large group that was involved in creating the doctrine for the future, the organizational structure, the requirements determination.
Gotcha.
And then I retired and then came back here to this area.
What are you up to now? Like your military career is over, but it's not.
I'm working harder now than I did in the military. That's what's so shocking about it. Because I can do a whole bunch of other stuff than just one job. In the military, they kind of control what you can't. I can't go work at 7-Eleven after hours. You know, they're going to want to know that.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, you belong to the military 24/7. So once I retired from the military, it opened up doors. When I did that, I went back into a Department of Defense contracting group.
Right.
And I went back and kind of did the same things that I came off active duty with.
I got you.
And what we say for senior officers, when you leave the military, you got about a lifespan of about 5 years of all the stuff that, you know, did that for about 5 years. I started my and what I always wanted to do when I retired, I wanted to start my own flight school. And I did that. So I've got a flight school down here at Enterprise right next to Fort Novosel. I've been running that for 10 years. So I teach private commercial instrument flight instructor, and I also do specialized training in upset prevention and recovery training. And then my contract ran out, and I'm like, you know, I really don't want to work behind a desk anymore doing PowerPoint slides. I've done that enough. So I looked into CAE that was doing the military fixed-wing training for the Army, and I got hired on as an advanced military instructor pilot. So I've been doing that for about 6 years now.
Nice.
So most of the time of the day, I get to spend upside down flipping the students out of control, and they have to figure out how to get the airplane back in control. I got the best office, I swear, in the world. When I look at it, everything is upside down and going crazy.
That's awesome. So let me back up a little bit here. You talked about your son being a major at the Pentagon. How many kids do you have?
So I, again, another blended family. I've got three boys. One, my oldest, is a major in the United States Army. He's at the Pentagon. I've got a middle son, Alex, who is a first officer for an American Airlines regional outfit.
Okay.
So he's flying first day. He's going to upgrade to captain here pretty soon. And then I've got another son who's working at Delta Airlines. He's an aviation mechanic technician there. And
okay.
I have a stepson who just left the Army, and he's trying to get on with the airport authority up in Anchorage, Alaska. So
you got to be super proud, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Found down the aviation pathway, and which is not an easy path. So that's impressive. Talk about Alabama. Let's leave the work out of it. What's life like in Alabama?
Yeah. So since I retired and I've had a house here, the last assignment that I had at San Antonio, I knew I was going to come back here. So my wife is currently teaching at Troy University. She's a professor a PhD, and she teaches accounting and specifically tax. And so she recently got her PhD, and now I've got somebody in the family that has a doctoral degree. So I'm like, okay, I've got a master's, but this ain't cutting in the family. So I've decided to go ahead and go back to school and get my PhD.
Good for you.
At Troy University. So I'm kind of doing that on the side and still working as a flight instructor, but I'm trying to stay busy, Rick. I don't want to retirement. The traditional word retirement, I'm not stepping down and doing it. If you don't stay busy, I think that you atrophy the brain and the body. Yeah. I watched my parents go through that. I want to stay as active as I can.
I'm with you. I'm the same way.
Can let Dr. Clint know as the motivator that I'm late, but I'm trying to knock out a PhD, and I want to go back after I'm done with the flying completely, go back to the university and teach and research. That's what I want. So the PhD will be in global leadership. I can't think of a better way for my background to kind of blend in and go out there and give something back to the students. You know, it's just, you know, Clint was it was my inspiration on that as well. I just wish I hadn't waited so late, but you know, school is school. Down, it's an eye opener. It's challenging,
right?
But be careful what you ask for; you just might get it.
Well, listen, I could take this conversation on all day. This is such a great example of the threads of connectivity and all the things that have happened in your life, right? And just the pathways. There's so many great people you've met along the way. Here's a last question for you. If looking at networking in the military is different than networking in the business community because you have an esprit de corps. I mean, your lives depend on each other. So it's a different caliber of networking. Like, what did you learn on networking and tips do you have for networking from a military perspective?
Well, one of those things that we are trained and educated on before we leave, the military takes they take great pride in preparing people to leave the military. It's a lot better than it used to be. They just don't say, hey, here you go. Here's your medal. Here's your retirement medal, your diploma, whatever. Go have a nice day. They don't do that anymore. So what they do is they prepare you for the separation at least a year out. Mm-hmm. So by doing that, you don't want to believe it. You know, 1 minute you're talking to the Secretary of the Army, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, or getting chewed out from a very famous general who will be on CNN as a commentator. All right.
Right.
I've been there because I've been on those receiving ends. But one minute you're in the military uniform, the next minute you're walking. The day that happens, it is very, very cold. So they try to prepare you, say, hey, look, you're going to have this transition. You need to come to grips with it. It's going to happen because the military has their culture. They have their communication. They have their networking. Right. Now you need to integrate this out to the outside.
Right.
It's a challenge. It's different. We all go through it. And it usually takes a military retiree about 5 years to make that transition to fully separate from the military and inculcate within the business network. You have to do that.
Right.
So that kind of happened to me as well. But, you know, I was fortunate enough. I had a job, a contracting job. Then I'm still able to fly. And now I want to go into the teaching profession. So that's been about 8 years since I retired. So that's about, you know, I'm ready to make that full transition to get totally away from the military. And so you got to educate yourself, take the courses, program management, you know, whatever, get in there, find out what's going on. LinkedIn is a great network. It opens up doors.
Well, listen, like I said, we could carry this conversation on. There's so many great things to talk about. But our time has come to an end here, Bob. I'm going to have to come to Rucker, though. I need to fly. I'm itching to fly, man.
Yeah, we can get you down here. Now, as we get ready to cut this off, Rick, I got to say something here. So if you just bear with me here for a second.
Please, go ahead.
Anyone that is watching this podcast, I will tell you that, one, Rick has got a great idea. We need to network as former athletes for UT, the Toledo area. It's important. It's vital to the economic growth of Ohio. There are so many things that people are doing that we just don't know about. And the podcast, I believe, has the opportunity to bring that to light on what people are doing. We got so many people that I played football with at UT that are leaders. They're natural born leaders. They're out there doing things. I may not know what they're doing now, but things like this can kind of open up the opportunity to kind of see what's going on out there.
Right.
And the other thing with this, Rick, as we close out, I just want to say thanks for what you do for the University of Toledo. We've been watching your updates on, you are bringing to light issues, and those are good, and they need to be addressed. And I just want to say thanks as a former athlete for UT, what you did for Chuck Ely. I will tell you, and with others that have agreed with me, you did the impossible. You kept climbing the mountain. It didn't look like it was going to get done, and you tackled the beast. And Chuck Ely, rightfully so, is in the Hall of Fame. And there is one person that we, not just for Chuck's ability, we know what that was about, but somebody had to be the fighter, the leader for that. And we, as a Rocket Nation, we want to say thank you, Rick, for everything that you did for Chuck Ely and what you do for the University of Toledo. It's imperative, and we just want to say thank you for all that you do, okay?
Listen, I appreciate the words. They mean a lot to me. And what I would say is the situation with Chuck Ely and UT in general, one person can make a difference. You know, I appreciate your kind words about the work we did to get Chuck in the Hall of Fame, but it literally took thousands of people. There was people from, quite frankly, Alabama right by you, University of Alabama. They did a great job putting pressure on the National Football Foundation because the situation with Chuck was beyond Chuck. It impacted other people. So I might have been an instigator, and I'll take that credit for being someone that never gave up. But, you know, Chuck Ely earned being in the Hall of Fame, and there's thousands and thousands of people that voiced it. And quite frankly, you know, Mike O'Brien, the former athletic director at the University of Toledo, and Christine Brennan, those two played a major, major role there. In that, you know, kind of sealing the deal, if you will, at the end. So, but with that said, I appreciate the comments. I do. And you could tell by my reaction to it, I'm much more comfortable giving compliments than taking.
Yeah, I can tell you're very uncomfortable right now. But
so I appreciate it. I do. And, you know, your military service means a lot to me. Rescuing down the soldiers that are in desperate need to get off the battlefield and get back, you and your team and your battalion, that's a heroic thing. So listen, that is a wrap for this episode of the Rocket Networker. And what I'd like to say in closing is just remember that at the Rocket Networker, we believe that it's time to launch connections to ignite your success. But the key question is, are you ready? To schedule a Rocket Networker training program or keynote speech, go to rocketnetworker.com. It's time to launch connections to ignite your success. Are you ready?